Hello everyone and welcome to the SRHM podcast. My name is Esther Kismödi and I am the Chief Executive of SRHM. Today's episode is the first of a series on rights-based sexual and reproductive health research and knowledge creation. In this first episode, I am speaking with three experts in this field. We introduce the concept of rights-based research, we discuss why rights matter, and what difference a rights-based approach to research and knowledge creation makes. My first guest is Sundari Ravindran, who is a Principal Visiting Fellow at the International Institute for Global Health of the United Nations University and the Senior Editor at the SRHM Journal. Hello, Sundari. Thank you very much for being here today.
Hi, Esther. I'm really happy for this opportunity to be here.
So, starting the conversation, Sundari, you have dedicated your entire career to the very subject of incorporating gender equality and rights into research, knowledge creation, policy, practice, and education. Can you please help us to understand what do we really mean by this concept? How do we define rights-based research as it relates to sexual and reproductive health?
Well, Esther, I think it is about bringing a human rights lens to the entire cycle of research or knowledge creation, from the very point of selecting a topic for research, to framing the research questions, deciding on the methodology and implementing the research, and in using the research findings. Now, you may ask, what does this mean to say bringing a human rights lens? I think personally for me, it means to keep in mind some of the principles and values, such as the right to healthcare, right to non-discrimination, the right to privacy, confidentiality, patient autonomy, to the values of accountability, transparency, and participation. So this is what informs the entire research cycle, and that is what I call rights-based research.
So just remaining a little bit on the research cycle, can you give some more details and example how rights can be integrated into the entire process of research and knowledge creation?
Yeah, before I start giving examples, I just want to say that many researchers who have been committed to social justice and equality have been doing this kind of rights-based approach to research for a very long time. We have now given it a name. And how do we do it? I would say when you choose a topic, you are thinking about human rights. It could be about whether and what ways human rights principles are being upheld by this topic or not. It could be about how discrimination has contributed to a risk of a specific SRH problem. It could be about some of the principles like informed consent for C-section, whether there is or the ways in which informed consent takes place. Or it could be about accountability and redress for obstetric violence within health systems and so on. So in choosing a topic, the topic itself could be about a human rights principle. Or it could be in framing of the research question for any area of sexual and reproductive health. For example, what has been the government's response to preserving SRH services during COVID-19 pandemic? So which human rights principles and values have been upheld in this response, or which of these have been violated? You could examine acceptance of IUD, for example, from a rights perspective. So the topic may be a general one in SRH, such as contraception, but the way you frame the question is from a rights perspective. You could be using rights approach in the conceptual framework. For example, the notion of what is safe delivery is framed along with the women who are affected by this. Or you could be using the research outcomes to foreground voices of marginalized groups or to empower them to demand accountability. So you do it all through the research cycle, from the topic to the research question to the methodology to the actual use of the research outcome.
It's very helpful, Sundari, that you are bringing all these specific examples that also remind us that all of these issues are very much connected to politics. And talking about the today world, we need to recognize that sexual and reproductive health and rights, laws, policies, programs across the world, and especially in particular settings, are increasingly influenced by ideology-inspired politics and rhetoric, which lack any basis of evidence, often violate human rights and damage health. Would you say that a rights-based approach is especially important for research on sexual and reproductive health? And if yes, why would you think so?
Yes, I do think that a rights-based approach to research is very especially important for sexual and reproductive health for at least three reasons. One, many sexual and reproductive health conditions originate from gender power inequalities or discrimination on the basis of gender, such as differences in sexual socialization, women's lack of power to make decisions, unequal access to resources, gender-based violence. Second, many policy and legislative barriers to accessing SRH services exist. So there are rights-violating policies such as criminalizing homosexuality and sex work, or non-recognition of marital rape as an offense, or no legal status for trans persons. And the third is that rights violation in service delivery, especially in many SRH services, is quite widely documented, such as denial of SRH services to young people, mandatory HIV testing for all women seeking antenatal care, or disrespect and abuse during provision of delivery and abortion services, and denial of services to trans persons, and so on. So the point is, if you do not bring out insights into specific rights violations that underlie many of the health problems, then there can be no policy interventions to address these situations. And so you will not really be helping improve the situation on the ground unless you pay attention to the rights dimensions in SRH issues when doing research on these issues.
Thank you so much, Sundari, for being here with us today. And now I'm turning to our second speaker, Laura Ferguson, who is the director of the Program on Global Health and Human Rights and the director of research at the USC Institute on Inequalities in Global Health. She is also an associate editor of SRHM. Hi, Laura. I hope you are well today. Thank you so much for being here.
Hi, Esther. It's a great pleasure. Lovely to hear you.
Laura, you have an extensive experience in integrating rights into research, policy, and program development and implementation. You have been working globally and with communities at the local level, with international institutions. In your experience, what difference a rights-based approach to research and knowledge creation makes?
Yeah, I think that rights brings a whole additional dimension to research around sexual and reproductive health. It really helps to identify the underlying denial or promotion of human rights, values, and norms for any sexual and reproductive health issue. And that's really the starting point for claiming the rights that make possible sexual and reproductive well-being. So what it does is it foregrounds marginalized voices. It brings attention to inequalities and also the drivers of inequalities. It helps to promote not only culturally acceptable actions, but also appropriate processes for their implementation. And really importantly, it brings attention to accountability. And you have to generate research around all of these issues for them to be considered in future action and implementation. So if you think about introducing a new family planning method, for example, if you wanted to integrate rights into research around that, a few of the things that you might want to consider would be to understand how can this method be made sustainably available through quality health services? How can we ensure its accessibility, including its affordability, to users? Is it acceptable to potential users and under what circumstances? Rights would also draw attention to how best to ensure that potential users are given adequate information to make an informed choice about whether or not to adopt this method. And rights makers question who might be left behind in this work and how we might avoid this. So we know a specific product works, but does it work for these particular women in this specific place? And I think bringing rights into sexual and reproductive health research, it provides the structure to systematically interrogate a range of issues to help understand this, to dig deeply into power imbalances and other structural factors that underlie sexual and reproductive health outcomes. So rather than applying a band-aid, this helps us get to the root causes.
With Sundari, we were discussing how rights and the rights-based approach influences the research process as a whole. Can you please tell us a little bit more about that, how introducing rights reshape the use of methodologies and can push methodological boundaries if it does so?
Absolutely, thanks. And just to agree with everything that Sundari said in terms of the approach to sexual and reproductive health research and how rights really changes that process. So it changes not just what we study, but how we study it in really important ways. In terms of methodologies, perhaps more than novel methodologies per se, I'd suggest that trying to incorporate attention to rights in sexual and reproductive health research, it requires novel combinations of methodologies and of data. So if you think about a lot of traditional sexual and reproductive health research is concerned with outcomes. For example, how many women got cervical cancer? Okay. If we apply a rights lens to this, we immediately want to also know which women got cervical cancer. Are certain populations more affected than others? So we might look at any original quantitative data about prevalence, but we might want to disaggregate it so that we can better understand inequalities. And that's one thing that brings very consistently. With rights, we also want to know, why did these women get cervical cancer? Can they not access screening? Are they uncomfortable with the fact that it might be a male nurse who performs the screening? So we might want to add in qualitative data collection so that we could understand different perspectives on this, maybe from the rights holder perspective, from the women, but also from the duty bearer perspective, from service providers. And legal and policy data might also help. For example, if only limited cadres of health workers are allowed to perform cervical cancer screening, that might limit where it's available. So we take these different types of data and analyze them together to look at the bigger picture. We broaden beyond the biomedical data, which is generally quantitative, and we center the individual and situate their sexual and reproductive health within the relevant legal, policy, and sociocultural context. And that's why combining these different types of data and methodologies can be so useful.
Just following up on the different perspectives, what I find absolutely fascinating in the conversation about rights-based research is the realization that talking about research and public health more broadly, we recognize that evidence is often understood differently by researchers, advocates, lawyers, law and policymakers, and service delivery professionals, and the communities whose rights and needs are being researched. How a rights-based approach, in your opinion, to research leads us to understand the notion of evidence differently or in different ways?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think a key consideration from the outset is what the purpose is of your research. Who are you generating evidence for and for what purpose? And I do think that rights invites a self-reflexivity and with its broad-based participation makes a range of stakeholders consider this from the outset. And there can be, as you say, real tensions between what interests funders, governments, and communities. And that can really affect not just the research questions you might ask, but also the evidence that you might collect to answer them. So funders might focus on internationally comparable data because they're funding programs across different places. Policymakers at the national level might be more focused on statistically significant p-values as evidence that an intervention works, or cost-effectiveness data that shows them how they'll save money. Communities likely don't want any of that. Their priorities, I mean, they're hugely varied, but they'll be much more locally tailored and could include things like, for example, you know, how local governance structures can be used to promote their own sexual and reproductive health priorities, which could be much more process-oriented qualitative data. So all of this informs how you generate evidence, because you have to generate what will be most useful and persuasive for your target audience. I think it's really important to consider this from the outset. A participatory research design and data collection process, which is a key element of a rights-based approach to research. It can be very labor-intensive, but it's incredibly useful because it can promote buy-in and ownership of evidence across a range of stakeholders. And that can really help promote uptake of the evidence at the end of the process. And finally, I think that one really important thing that rights-based research can help with is exposing and questioning the implicit assumption that numbers are objective while qualitative data is subjective. And we see that a lot in public health, that people really want to rely on numbers as a truth. But somebody always decides what to measure and how to measure it, and also what not to measure. And that's as subjective in statistical modeling as in an interview or a focus group discussion. And I think because rights-based research brings together these different types of data, their respective and their joint value can be better appreciated across different stakeholders.
Thank you so much, Laura, for this very insightful conversation and being with us here today. Thank you.
Thank you, Esther. I've enjoyed talking to you.
I'm turning now to my third guest, Sabina Faiz Rashid, who is the Dean and Professor at Prag James P. Grant School of Public Health at Prague University, Dhaka, Bangladesh. And she is also a member of our editorial advisory board in SRHM. Hello, Sabina. It's such a great pleasure of having you in this conversation.
Hi, Esther. Thank you for inviting me.
Sabina, in our discussions over the past couple of months, or now it's becoming years, you kept emphasizing that introducing a rights discourse to research can lead to a creation of a more equitable ethos in research. Can you please tell more about it? What does it really mean?
So I just wanted to make a few points here that when you talk about rights-based research and we're talking about sort of new types of knowledge creation, it inevitably brings into question questions about privilege, poverty, equity, one's positionality, location, and that hierarchy, and one's voice. How audible is it? Do you have the voice or the position or the location to state what you want, what you need, the kind of research you do? And what about voices that are muted or invisible? And I think we need to look a little bit on those paradigms that inform and dictate the kinds of research agendas, who leads it, the kinds of resources, funders. And I think it also goes back to now increasingly questions around not only rights-based research, but how do we decolonize global health in these discussions, right? So in fact, even the way funding is structured and the way research is structured, there are certain kinds of ingrained practices and knowledge that don't always or necessarily engage with communities. And I'd like to talk a little bit about communities as well.
I would love to hear your further ideas about the communities, Sabina.
When we look at the way, you know, there's hierarchies of knowledge, there's hierarchy, even within health or global health. And I'm a medical anthropologist in a school of public health. When you spend time with communities, what do we mean by communities? We really need to unpack and critically reflect, because we homogenize the poor. We group, you know, different communities together. Sex workers, we lump them together. We informal slum residents, we lump them together. It's extremely heterogeneous, very diverse groups with diverse needs and priorities. And I think one thing we don't actually think about when we kind of make these generalized comments or discussions around communities is, do we engage and work with diverse groups from different areas and different urban, rural sort of sites, or what we say is field work, when we're doing research? And what do we mean by engaging with diverse groups and communities? What do we mean by partnerships? Because if we're looking at rights-based approaches and putting communities in the center, that automatically means that we have to recognize intersectional factors that impact on different groups, you know, age, class, ethnicity, religion, where you live. And I think that's very important to critically reflect. And then, are we working with these different groups, with, not about them, not on them, about the question, very questions we want to ask? Is it led by and developed by the very communities, heterogeneous groups that we're working with? And how do we engage with them in that design, developing, and even at the policy level? Do they have a seat at the table? Do we validate our findings? We discuss these sort of findings with various communities. And a lot of it's about context and looking at social science research, which is also sadly missing or sort of under kind of valued in public health data. Yeah.
So would you like to, Sabina, talk a little bit about what the reconfiguration of partnership with communities and at the center means from the research process and the research methodology perspective?
So one thing I think as researchers, it goes back to the values of why do we do research? Why are we in the field or disciplines that we're in? Are we doing research for the sake of research, or research that matters? Research, because we have to realize we're just merely enablers, right? We're not saviors of the communities that we're learning from. So I think it's like taking a step back and saying, what is our ethos around the research? And part of it, and a lot of it, is humility, respectful listening, trying to understand the various contexts of these heterogeneous groups within these communities. And the first step is trying to inculcate that sort of ethos within us. And then also trying to, the tools, the questions we develop, how much of it is led by and designed by various different groups and actors within those communities? Are they part of this entire research process? And I think that's very important.
I'm very glad that you emphasize this, Sabina. We talk so much about it, and yet many research processes completely forgetting about this perspective and give a meaningful actual process to community participation.
So Esther, I just want to say one thing. It's not about just saying community engagement, inviting communities here. I really think at every level, we need to critically reflect on what do we mean by engagement? How do we respectfully work with communities about their lives, about their needs and priorities? And that should inform the research questions and directions and even program design and interventions and inform policies. And that requires structured ways of changing the way we work, not just lip service to the terminologies, right? That often is fashionable to use, but it's just tokenism. I think it's just something I challenge myself and critique myself. And I would say we all need to think about this critically. Yeah.
Absolutely. And it also requires resources. We always forget to budget participation when it actually, respectfully,
and I
also requires the budgetary considerations.
I don't know if it's, yes, it does require budgetary I don't find budgets is the major barrier. I think it's our own, we need to have our own internal paradigm shift of how we understand, view communities and what we mean by engagement.
Absolutely.
It's not so much more expensive in a budget, particularly working in Bangladesh. It's about having that internal paradigm shift of how do we view communities? What is our ethos when we want to say it's a meaningful partnership with the diverse groups of community members at the center, right? And then what does it mean for methodology, as you said?
Absolutely. So Sabina, you are an innovator and a pioneer on rights-based work, dean of a public health school, an educator, a scholar, a researcher. In my mind, you are an activist, how you put all of these together and translating it to meaningful practice. How do you see the challenges and opportunities in these new ways of thinking that is driven by and influenced by human rights?
I think one thing that is important for people, I mean, first of all, thank you for your generous sort of words about me. I think for me, working in Bangladesh for 25 years, I think one thing I try and do is push the boundaries by discussing internally within my own faculty and team of researchers of critically reflecting on how are we trying to involve communities? What are our failures? What are we learning from our failures? So there's a constant push wherever feasible, right? Because the reality is the challenges are there's certain implicit assumptions about hierarchies of knowledge. And unfortunately, that is dominated by certain frameworks, by certain kinds of disciplines, but also communities tend to be at the bottom of that kind of research agendas, right? And I think one of the opportunities is podcasts like this to discuss these issues. I teach on methodologies at my school, and we have about 534 alumni graduates from 31 different countries. So training young minds and researchers is an important part of this journey. We've started doing a curriculum reform at the school where we put communities at the center of discussions. So I think these are all sort of steps in it. Another key point, I think, which I'm trying to do at the school with colleagues, senior management, is that we really emphasize young people who are researchers, particularly mid-level researchers, to work with communities, lead and try and co-author papers. Not always community members, I have to say that has been a challenge, but trying to get them to think a little bit outside of the box. And one of the issues that is very dear to my heart is sort of the sexual minorities. And we continue to do a lot of advocacy and research to promote their rights. Because I think at the end of the day, you know, for me, it's very, very important to have sort of social justice as part of human rights and public health. And that's been a lot of my research and work. It's a struggle, it's a challenge, but I think the more space we get to discuss, try and change the way we teach, the content, the research we do, these are small steps, and that's very important. Trying to change the ethos and trying to get people to critically reflect, not just researchers, practitioners, academics, having conversations and learning from each other. Learning from each other is so important, including the very communities, working with them and learning from them. I think that's very important.
Thank you so much, Sabina, for being here today. We really appreciate your wisdom and thoughts sharing with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Esther and SRHM. It's a pleasure and an honor for me to be able to speak and share. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you to Sundari Ravindran, Laura Ferguson, and Sabina Faiz Rashid for speaking with SRHM. This was the first episode of an episode series on rights-based sexual and reproductive health research and knowledge creation. Future episodes will cover the topics of accountability, consent and autonomy, non-discrimination, and participation. Please look forward to our next episode on accountability in June and our upcoming dialogue series and journal special issue on the topic. The SRHM podcast is produced by Alex Bramshi, Communication Manager of SRHM, in collaboration with We Edit Podcasts Company. The music was composed by Tiber Christian and Salomon Botond. I am Esther Kismödi, Chief Executive of SRHM. Thank you very much for listening.